From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church, Frank Griswold. His successor, who was elected last week, is a woman. That's pretty controversial in the church, but not nearly as divisive as the controversy over the ordination of gay bishops. Last week at the Episcopal Church's triennial convention, Bishop Griswold offered a compromise resolution over ordaining gay bishops. Yesterday, the Archbishop of Canterbury released a statement proposing a possible split within the church. Also, Superman returns, David Edelstein has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church, Frank Griswold. His 9-year tenure ends in November. At the church's triennial meeting last week, Catherine Jeffert Shorey was elected to succeed him. Electing a woman was pretty controversial, but not nearly as divisive as the ordination in 2003 of an openly gay bishop, Gene Robinson. The worldwide Anglican Church, which the U.S. Episcopal Church is part of, could split apart over this issue. My guest, Bishop Griswold, who supported Robinson's ordination, offered a compromise resolution that was passed last week, saying that the Church will not consent to the consecration of any candidate to the episcopate whose manner of life presents a challenge to the wider Church and will lead to further strains on the communion. Yesterday, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, released a letter suggesting that the Church explore the possibility of dividing into a two-tiered system in which churches which disagreed with the shared covenant would lose decision-making power. I asked Bishop Griswold his reaction to the Archbishop's letter.
I think the Archbishop, in his reflections, is taking the long view. He's inviting all of us, regardless of our own particular perspectives, to answer the question, what does it mean to be Anglicans in a multicultural world where communication is instantaneous, where what goes on here becomes a reality in a living room in Nigeria by virtue of television seconds later? And in answering that question, I think he hopes that we will come to a new sense of a common mind, a common mission for the sake of the world.
But what does he propose?
Well, he proposes a long process involving the provinces of the Anglican Communion, and he talks about a balance between fidelity to the Bible, our sacramental tradition, and a habit of cultural and intellectual flexibility that doesn't seek to close down unexpected questions too quickly. And those are the classic strands of Anglicanism he holds out.
The Archbishop is suggesting the possibility of a two-tiered system. There would be constituent churches that would retain full status within the church, and there would be churches in association that would not have decision-making status. Would it be fair to assume that the churches that maintain full power would be those that opposed the ordination of gay bishops, and the churches that did not have decision-making status would be those that supported ordination of gay bishops?
I think the Archbishop is not suggesting that as a solution. He's saying that could be a possible outcome of a long and careful process of building a sense of communion together. And I think it's wrong to focus on the end point rather than on the process to which he calls us.
What is the process?
I think the process is a question of what is our Anglican identity given our tradition of biblical fidelity, sacramental life, and our ability to live difficult questions in an open and honest way.
Do you think that more conservative leaders within the church are reading this letter in the same way that you do?
I think the letter is quite extensive and requires very careful reading. The Archbishop is a very subtle theologian, and I think it's quite easy for people to take out of it whatever they want for their own purposes, and therefore it's very important to read it as a whole.
One of the things that he says is there is no way in which the Anglican Communion can remain unchanged by what is happening at the moment. How do you interpret that?
I think the church is always evolving and growing. It's a living and dynamic thing, and therefore I would be very unhappy if the Anglican Communion were unchanging. It would suggest to me that it was being unfaithful to Christ.
In the New York Times today, it says that many provinces in the church have already tried to break with the church. 22 of 38 provinces have already declared their ties with the American church to be broken or impaired. As the head bishop of the Episcopal Church in the U.S., have churches declared that to you? What does that mean?
A number of archbishops have, in fact, declared our relationships strained or broken in one way or another. And others have expressed deep concern about decisions we've made in the Episcopal Church with the hope that we can remain in communion together for the sake of mission. So the responses are various in intensity and various in meaning.
Is there anything you see in the Archbishop's letter that you interpret as an endorsement of gay rights within the church?
I think the Archbishop is very careful to talk about the dignity of human beings and the need to treat gay and lesbian people with dignity. And I think for some people in the Anglican Communion to be able to do that is a major step, given some of the negative rhetoric and dehumanizing rhetoric about gay and lesbian people that has come from various parts of the world. So I think the Archbishop's letter is a challenge to all of us to find a higher way together for the sake of mission.
The Archbishop's letter was released, you know, just a few days after the American Episcopal Church's meeting. The meeting was last week. Do you see his letter as in any way a rebuke to the meeting or to your resolution at the meeting, which we'll discuss in a moment?
No, I think that obviously the letter in some way was provoked by the General Convention, but I can assure you the Archbishop has been thinking along these lines well before the General Convention, and he acknowledges the extremely hard work that went into the resolution with which the convention ended.
Would you describe that resolution?
The resolution has to do with calling upon bishops and standing committees of dioceses to exercise restraint in the election and consent to candidates for the episcopal office whose manner of life could be problematic in the life of the communion. That's essentially what the resolution says. And its purpose is to foster conversation, to make it possible for our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters to be part of the global conversation that has been called for by the Archbishop, which in his letter he admits hasn't proceeded very far.
So when you're calling for exercising restraint, is that different from asking for a moratorium on the ordination of gay bishops?
I think its effect is essentially the same. It's asking that we not do something in order that something else can take place, namely, we can participate in the global conversation that is causing such difficulty in other parts of the world and bring our experience into that conversation.
What is the importance of conversation for you? You're stressing the importance of conversation.
Conversation often leads to conversion. If you approach the other with an undefended heart, you will be changed by that encounter. It doesn't mean your point of view is going to change, but your relationship may well change. And the person you see as threat, you can then see as brother or sister, and you can actually discern the presence of Christ in their otherness. And that is the gift of communion. That's what communion is all about, and that's the challenge before the Anglican Communion at the present time.
If opposition to gay bishops remained really strong, do you think at some point you and other people who agree with you within the Episcopal and Anglican Church would have to basically decide which was the more important principle to them, holding the church together or giving full support to gay people within the church and to their right to be equal within the church?
I think there could come a moment when one would have to make a very costly decision. But until that moment comes, I am fully committed to the process outlined by the Archbishop of Canterbury and the development of a covenant that delineates more clearly for the 21st century what our identity as Anglican Christians is for the sake of mission.
Where does the issue of homosexual marriage stand now, the blessing of same-sex unions, where does that stand now within the Episcopal Church?
Well, the Episcopal Church has not endorsed the development of rights for the blessing of same-sex union, so the question really resides mostly in the realm of pastoral practice at the local level.
And what has that practice been? What's the diversity of that practice? Are there some who do and some who don't?
I think that's essentially it, yes.
In other words, there's no official position now?
At this point, there is no endorsement of same-sex blessings.
Can I just read you a sentence from the Archbishop's letter, and if you could tell me how you would interpret this. He writes, "It is possible, indeed it is imperative, to give the strongest support to the defense of homosexual people against violence, bigotry, and legal disadvantage, to appreciate the role played in the life of the church by people of homosexual orientation, and still to believe that this doesn't settle the question of whether the Christian Church has the freedom, on the basis of the Bible and its historic teachings, to bless homosexual partnerships as a clear expression of God's will. That is disputed among Christians, and, as a bare matter of fact, only a small minority would answer yes to the question.
My sense is that the Archbishop is, first of all, recognizing the place and dignity and value of gay and lesbian people, homosexual persons in the life of the Church, but he's also saying that the formal blessing of their relationships is a question yet unsettled, and at this moment in time, the majority of Anglican Christians would say that the Bible does not allow such blessing. I think that's what he's saying.
Do you know what his personal stand on the issue is?
I have some idea, and I think historically he has taken a very accommodating view toward the reality of homosexual relationships, committed relationships. I think he is also very aware of being the Archbishop of Canterbury, the symbolic head of an international community of churches, and that role precludes his acting out of his own personal views.
My guest is the presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church, Frank Griswold. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is the outgoing presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church, Frank Griswold. His 9-year term ends in November. His successor was just elected. Now, your successor, who was just elected, is a woman. And this will be the first time that a woman is in that position of the presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church. How controversial is that within the American church?
I think the American Episcopal Church, by and large, I mean the overwhelming majority, happily accept the ministry of women. I think it's been a process of discovery. I think it remained for a long time an abstraction, but as it was embodied in women who ministered gracefully in all sorts of situations, people have more and more seen that the charism for ministry can certainly be borne by women. And I think it's that reality experienced over time that has led the bishops to elect, with a quite strong majority, a woman to be my successor.
How many churches within the U.S. Episcopal Church don't accept the ordination of women?
I don't know how many churches. I can say that there are, I believe, 3 dioceses out of 100 in the United States that do not recognize the ordination of women.
Now, when you were ordained in, was it 1963?
1963.
There were no women bishops within your church then.
No, I remember in about 1965 conducting a discussion group for a group of Bryn Mawr College students, and one of them asked me, can women be ordained? And at that point, I simply laughed and said, of course not, because it was unthinkable. But by 1976, I was at a general convention and voting in favor of the ordination of women. So things can change rather quickly, and one's own views can be expanded rather quickly as well.
Did the church ever come close to splitting over the issue of the ordination of women?
There were some churches, congregations, that broke away when we accepted the ordination of women to the priesthood and the episcopate, but there weren't many. Some also left over the revision of the prayer book, and some certainly have left over questions of human sexuality as well. But those numbers are not large, though I will say, as the overseer of the whole church, I'm saddened when anyone feels that they must walk apart because of something that the church has done or a place where the church, at least the majority, seem to stand.
What do you think the odds are that the Episcopal Church will split in two?
I usually avoid hypothetical questions. My sense is, again, that the overwhelming majority is a diverse center of different points of view committed to being the church together. And that's true across the Anglican world. There's some very fierce rhetoric coming from various places. And yet, in those same places, there are many lay people, especially women, who've gathered internationally and said, enough of this nonsense that these men are carrying out. We're together for the sake of our families and the well-being of our children. But there are also a number of bishops who quietly will say, the last thing we want is some kind of separation because we need to work together for the sake of the world. And I trust that that larger sense of working together for the sake of the world will be where we ultimately find ourselves.
How has the controversy over gay bishops affected your relationship with other bishops? I understand some bishops declined to take communion with you, for example.
I would say that, some bishops probably see me as the incarnation of evil. Few, but I think some probably do, and others have seen me, at least until the General Convention, as a sort of a hero. And I think, I pray that I'm neither. I hope in some way that I am faithful to the complexities of trying to be a faithful person and a leader in a world in which there are so many divergences and diversities and contrary points of view. Sorting and sifting all that and trying to find what is God's larger purpose is certainly where I've put my best energies over these years.
You said some people saw you as a hero until the convention. Did they see you as a sellout afterwards because you offered a compromise resolution?
I think for some people, yes. The fact that I said it's important for us to draw back in order to take part in a larger conversation that will allow the experience of gay and lesbian people to be taken seriously, I think for some that was seen as a pulling back.
When Bishop Robinson was ordained and became the first openly gay Episcopal bishop, to the ordination ceremony you wore a flak jacket, as I believe did he. Did you say to yourself, what is this world coming to that I have to wear a flak jacket to be part of the
ceremony? Quite frankly, I was more amused than scared by that. I went along with it because that's what I was asked to do. And I also thought that if indeed something did occur, which I felt was completely unlikely, it would have been foolish for me not to have taken that step to protect myself.
In the nearly 9 years that you've been the presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church, what do you consider one of your greatest or one of the church's greatest accomplishments? You know, we've talked about divisions within the church, but what's something that you think the church united and stood up for and really accomplished something?
I would say there's several things. First of all, I think the church is much clearer about being a body committed to mission, a work of reconciliation that has a global component. And I'm very, very pleased that our General Convention voted overwhelmingly to include in our budget in a very generous way support of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, which are focused on hunger, education, and alleviation of disease, and things that really do affect us in life and death ways and affect brother and sister Anglicans and others across the world. So I see that focus on mission as something that's been very important. The other thing I would say is I've stressed throughout the last 9 years, conversation as a discipline. Conversation and conversion come from the same Latin root. And if you open yourself deeply in conversation to the other, you may in fact be converted in some way, changed in your perceptions by what you hear. That may not mean a change in point of view, but it may mean a change at the level of the heart. You may see the other not as enemy and threat, but the other as brother or sister, even though they have a different point of view. And out of that can emerge a capacity to be together in common action. And so I've stressed, in the midst of all this division and polarization, the discipline of conversation, speaking with the other in the hope of everyone learning and a mutuality evolving that allows us then to work together for the sake of the world.
Do you feel that that's happened to you, that through conversation you've had a fundamental change of heart?
Absolutely. I mean, I've traveled the world and entered into very different cultural experiences where fellow Anglicans try to embody the gospel in very different circumstances. And I am very respectful. I understand some of the difficulties of what we've done being interpreted in other parts of the world as something positive. If you live, for example, in northern Nigeria, which is very much a very militant Islamic part of Nigeria, you can't afford the kind of theological latitude that we can enjoy here in the United States. You have to be just as absolute and certain in your presentation of the Christian faith as your Muslim interlocutors are about their faith. So when people here say, oh, they're so rigid, I say, wait a minute, we can afford a kind of openness that our brothers and sisters can't have where they live. So I've been changed profoundly by my own experiences of other cultures and other modes of Christian faithfulness.
Frank Wiswold is the presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Letters from the Hive, An Intimate History of Bees, Honey, and Humankind by Stephen Buckman and Banning Replier. And from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Frank Wiswold looks back on his tenure as presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church and talks about his life in the church. And David Edelstein reviews Superman Returns. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bishop Frank Wiswold, the presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church. His 9-year tenure ends in November. He's presided over a divisive period within the church. It may split apart over the issue of the ordination of gay bishops. Bishop Griswold was ordained as a priest in 1963. Being a bishop, do people assume that you have a special connection to God? And that that being a bishop just inherently brings you closer to God, or as a sign that you already were closer to God?
The wonderful paradox of being a bishop, at least in the Anglican tradition, is the more elaborate your title becomes and the more magnificent the vesture you put on, the more you are stripped inwardly and the more you have to confront your own interior poverty. And in the midst of that discovery, you discover your companionship with Christ in a whole new and much deeper way. So I would say my own faith as a Christian has deepened tremendously because I'm shot at from a number of directions, and all sorts of projections are thrust upon me. You must do this, you must do that, or a good bishop does this, and if you want to be a good bishop, you must do this, those sorts of things. And so you ultimately have to sort of find your grounding beyond the externals of the institution and beyond the perceived grandiosity of your own office. If you take yourself too seriously, I think you are in great danger. Fortunately, I've been given, insight into the divine sense of humor and can apply it to myself.
It seems to me from the outside that being a bishop would probably immerse you in the power politics and administrative work of religion, and that can sometimes not be the most spiritual place to be, power politics and administration. So are there things you have to be wary of when you're a bishop?
I think you have to be wary of taking yourself too seriously. I think you have to stay rooted and grounded in an active and authentic faith life that is beyond the institution. One thing I do every year, I go off for a 10-day retreat with a wonderful Jesuit who, though blind, can see better than any sighted person I know, and he can see right into Frank Griswold and isn't interested in Frank Griswold as bishop, and that is very, very helpful to me. And my daily patterns of prayer and spiritual direction occasionally with a wise counselor keep me from becoming, what would I say, the victim of the institution.
Now, you mentioned the vestments. What are your vestments as a bishop?
Well, there's a hat, a pointed hat called a mitre, and then you carry a staff, which is called a crozier, or since I'm the presiding bishop and primate, it's a primatial cross, but it's the same idea. And, you know, there are various overgarments called copes and chasubles that you put on. So you can stand in front of a mirror and fully dressed and feel quite self-important if you forget that underneath it you are simply a human being trying as best you can to respond to the motions of the Spirit and trying to be faithful to what God has placed before you.
What do you think of as being the purpose of those vestments, and do you feel transformed in any way that is useful when you put them on?
Well, I think liturgy is a form of, and I use this term advisedly, sacred play. Liturgy is non-utilitarian in one way, but its symbols convey larger meanings and in many ways connect people with a more profound sense of mystery beyond the immediate moment. And certainly part of liturgy is the costuming that accompanies liturgy. So I would see it all as part of, witness to the transcendent in the midst of the everyday and now.
Does putting on those vestments give you the sense of either spirituality or theater that you feel you need or that is helpful in conducting a service?
I think in the midst of conducting a service, I feel very much that I am an instrument of God. That also means that I'm aware of myself as myself, and I'm also aware that the gestures and movements all are a form of punctuation and underscoring the larger purpose of what I'm doing. So I take seriously what you might call the theatrical dimension of it as well.
I love theater, and I don't mean that in a
No,
in
I know you don't. I know you don't, but for some people to say that there's theater associated with this would sound demeaning. But how you move liturgically, you know, how you go down an aisle, all that sort of thing, is part of how you serve the larger mystery.
What were the big controversies in your church when you were ordained in 1963?
When I was first ordained, the division within the church was something called high church and low church. And it had very much to do, in put in simple terms, with those who were more focused on the Protestant Reformation and those who were more focused on the continuing Catholic elements of the Anglican tradition. And you could go into two Episcopal churches and not recognize them as the same church at
all. What would some of the differences
have been? Well, one would be very, very bare, with a minimum of decoration, and the other would be filled with candles, statues, lace altar cloths, and all the things that would suggest a Roman Catholic worship. And I remember Episcopalians who were brought up in one tradition walking into a church of the other tradition and being shocked at how different it was and feeling that these were really two churches. And some of the battles between high and low church were very ugly indeed. So controversy changes from time to time. The issues change. And I say to people who say, oh, when will this be over, this whole controversy over sexuality? Then we can be at peace. I say, wait a minute, something else will arise.
Well, how is the high-low church controversy and split settled?
I think it was settled largely by the revision of a prayer book, which brought together in large measure those two factions. And so high and low church is no longer really an operative dimension within the Episcopal Church, though I think it's fair to say some are more Bible-centered and some are more liturgically, sacramentally centered.
Which tradition did you come from, the high or the low church?
I came from a high church tradition, though when I was first ordained, I served in what would have been called a low church parish, which taught me how to be flexible and look beyond the externals and see that there was actually a continuity of faith, even though that faith was somewhat differently articulated. I think that has served me well throughout the years. I look for the common ground in the midst of things that seem so divisive.
How did your parents practice religion when you were growing up? What was the style of religion that you were brought up with?
I was brought up in what I would call cultural Episcopalianism. I was baptized on the 1st of January 1938, which would have been my grandfather's 100th birthday. That was the reason for the day being chosen, though it also turned out to be a holy day, but that was incidental. And I never went near a church except for an occasional Christmas pageant when my mother felt guilty around Christmas time until I was sent away in the 8th grade to an Episcopal boarding school in New Hampshire. And there I was in the choir and fascinated by the liturgy and the complexity of the rites of the church. And there were seven priests on the faculty who took an interest in me. And so I, in a very organic way, simply evolved into a person of faith. And by the end of my time at that school, it was clear to me that I wanted to be ordained. And this was supported by several of the clergy.
What about your parents? What was their reaction? Were they surprised?
My mother was pleased with that. My father was appalled and uncomprehending. It was very threatening to him.
Why?
I think he'd had a very difficult experience of the church as a young man. He'd been sent as a discipline to live with a priest. It was sort of a punishment. And so his sense of the church was a punishing sense, whereas my mother had a much more positive experience of the church as a young girl.
Why was he sent? What was he being punished for? And I can't say I've ever heard of that as a punishment for a boy before.
Well, apparently he had struck another little boy, and my grandmother was so appalled that she sent him off to live with this priest for a while to learn gentler ways.
I guess he didn't. I mean, no. I guess it's not exactly the lesson he took away from
that. No, it isn't at all.
So did he ever come around to thinking that you had really found your place in the world by becoming part of the church?
He died shortly after I was ordained a priest, so he wasn't around to see my evolution. And my sense is that he's probably watching from afar and now is in a much better frame with respect to what I'm up to. And I hope that I have his blessing.
Did you feel called to be a priest? And if so, would you describe what that means to you?
My call happened in a very funny way. My roommate at the boarding school I mentioned came back one Sunday afternoon from a visit to one of the clergy, fell on his bed roaring with laughter, and pointed at me and said, Father Jones says you should be a priest. And the idea was so shocking and yet fascinating that it sort of stayed with me and developed over time. And I think sometimes a sense of vocation overtakes you in a way that surprises you. And my sense of vocation has changed tremendously over the years. I mean, I saw myself as this sort of perfect priest when I was still in school and college. And certainly the vicissitudes of actually living the life of a priest in several congregations and then life as a bishop has stretched and changed my sense of vocation. But I feel very much that it's a right thing for me to have undertaken, and I feel very much at peace with it.
My guest is the presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church, Frank Griswold. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bishop Frank Griswold. He is the presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church, and his nine-year tenure will end in November. Let's get to another controversy that you've been involved in, and that is you've spoken out against the war in Iraq and against, you said the unilateral military action undermines the United States' efforts to create a more secure and stable world. In February of 2003, you said, we are loathed, and I think the world has every right to loathe us because they see us as greedy, self-interested, and almost totally unconcerned about poverty, disease, and suffering. You said, I'd like to be able to go somewhere in the world and not have to apologize for being from the U.S. What kind of reactions have you gotten from inside and outside your church to those comments?
I've gotten, obviously, mixed reactions. There are those who said, thank you for saying it. And others have said, why don't you simply move to Iraq? And I think one of the reasons that I said what I said was the experience in Africa of an archbishop who had 55 AIDS orphans in his house and asked me why the United States at that point had sided with pharmaceutical companies against making antiretrovirals available essentially at cost. And I was hard-pressed, obviously, to give an answer. And I think one thing I've seen in various parts of the world is the fear of American domination, both in terms of culture, and it's amazing what we export culturally that is really debased, to say the least, and the way in which we undermine local economies and social structures by having, you know, sneakers made somewhere or other, and we see ourselves as benefiting the local community when, in fact, we inadvertently destroy the structure of the rural communities. So we're seen in other parts of the world not always as beneficent, which is, of course, the way we'd like to see ourselves. I think we are, as a people, very generous, but I think we need to be more self-critical in how we deport ourselves and relate ourselves to other parts of the world.
Your successor as presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church is a woman. You've traveled around the world, and you've been to parts of the church in parts of the world that don't accept women as equals, that don't think women should be ordained, let alone be bishops. What are some of the things that you think she will be up against in her role in terms of people, you know, in the church accepting her?
I've noticed that women bishops have been treated very respectfully by bishops from other parts of the Anglican Communion where women are not ordained, and I have every sense that Bishop Catherine Jeffords Shorey will be treated respectfully as well. And I need to say, too, that after her election, there was a flood of emails from various parts of Africa, women in various parts of Africa, saying, hooray, congratulations, we're praying for you. So if you see the Anglican world not simply as male, but as male and female, and you listen to the voices of women equally as you listen to the voices of men, you can see that the election of a presiding bishop in this country who is a woman is perceived in many, many parts of the world that don't ordain women as something very positive and hopeful for women everywhere.
You know, in some ways, I'm wondering if you think that the power structure within your church and other churches as well doesn't really reflect the larger feeling that you want from the church. The largest feeling that you want from the church, you've said, is diversity, conversation with people whose views are very different than your own, to help you test the truths that you believe in, to help you keep your mind open. But the power structure of most churches, yours included, is largely male, heterosexual, I'd say white, except that there's a lot of churches around the world, like in Africa,
right, exactly.
where the power structure
yes, Anglicanism
is not white.
Is no longer
yes,
white.
Exactly, exactly. But anyways, do you think that the power structure, the hierarchy of the church, has a lot of catching up to do before it reaches what your ambition of the church is, which is diversity?
I think there is a profound transformation going on. And obviously it takes time because it has to be lived out historically. It can't just simply be dropped from on high. And so I think we're seeing some of that now. I mean, the Church of England, which hasn't ordained women to the episcopate, is now seriously considering that possibility. And increasingly in provinces in Africa, women are being ordained. So I see things shifting and changing. And ultimately, what we're about is gender equity in the decision-making life of the church. There need to be women at the table alongside men so that there can be a true balance and the totality of what the Spirit is trying to do can be represented by men and women together.
Is there anything that you really hoped to accomplish in your tenure as presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church that you feel like you wish you had, but you're not going to be able to do it?
What I've hoped to do, and only time will tell, is keep people with differing points of view together in one larger conversation to the point where they can recognize Christ in one another, and having done so, ask the question, how can we be about mission together? How can we serve this broken, bleeding world?
Thank you very much for talking with us.
But thank you very much. I've very much enjoyed this.
Bishop Frank Griswold, his 9-year tenure as presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church ends in November. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Superman Returns. This is Fresh Air. Superman returns today, although he's never really been away. There have been two popular TV series devoted to his exploits, Lois and Clark and Smallville, and the Superman comics are still around, but his last big-screen adventure was 20 years ago. The new feature is directed by Bryan Singer, who made The Usual Suspects and X-Men, and it features newcomer Brandon Routh as Superman and Kevin Spacey as Lex Luthor. David Edelstein has a review.
Ever since Tim Burton's Batman, filmmakers have moved beyond the clean-cut, all-American aspects of comic book superheroes to explore their freaky alienation, asking, What is it about these outlandish characters that connects with our ordinary fears and longings? If nothing else, this trend allows directors like Burton, Christopher Nolan, and even Ang Lee to make movies for the teenage male demographic without losing their self-respect. In the first two X-Men movies, Bryan Singer made genetic mutancy a thinly veiled metaphor for homosexuality, and he must have seemed the perfect choice to give Superman a new depth and urgency. But in Superman Returns, he goes so far in the direction of seriousness that he loses the material's pop pulse. Before the credits, we learn that Superman has been absent from Earth for 5 years in a vain search for survivors from his exploded home planet Krypton. Then Marlon Brando appears as Superman's father, Jor-El, in footage from the 1978 original, reminding us of the grotesque waste of talent in the actor's final 25 years. The John Williams theme and the familiar flying credits signal the series won't be starting over, so no matter how good the new guy is, we'll feel the loss of Christopher Reeve. As it turns out, the new guy, Brandon Routh, isn't very good at all, and when he is, it's because he's channeling Reeve's dithering as Clark Kent and sheepish little grin at his own prowess as the Man of Steel. In the first scene, an elderly woman expires after leaving her fortune to arch-villain Lex Luthor, and she's played by Noel Neal, the marvelous Lois Lane from the 50s TV show. Is this a comeback or a funeral? In Superman Returns, Lois Lane, played by Kate Bosworth, has just won a Pulitzer for an editorial called Why the World Doesn't Need Superman, an obvious expression of rage at her own abandonment. I had a brief hope the movie would turn into a sort of comedy of remarriage, Superman and Lois in His Girl Friday. But there's no chance with Bosworth. She isn't a bad actress, but she's motorless, with guileless little eyes, and the hotshot investigative reporter Lois is now an overprotective single mom with a frail boy and an earnest fiancé. Listen to the painfully sincere dialogue in her first meeting alone with Superman on the roof of the Daily Planet.
Let's start with the big question. Where'd you go?
To Krypton.
But you told me it was destroyed. Ages ago.
It was. But when astronomers thought they found it, I had to see for myself.
Well, you're back. And everyone seems to be pretty happy about it.
Not everyone. I read the article, Lois.
Yeah, so did a lot of people. Tomorrow night they give me the Pulitzer.
Why did you write it?
You leave us like that. I moved on. So did the rest of us. That's why I wrote it. The world doesn't need a savior. And neither do I.
There are exciting scenes in Superman Returns, like the Man of Steel running faster, as the catchphrase goes, than a speeding bullet. And there's a sequence in which he rescues a plane that should be every bit as thrilling as the one in Spider-Man 2, where Spidey stops a speeding subway car. But even the movie's superheroics have a pall over them. They're like stopgap measures in a world slipping grimly into the abyss. Instead of accelerating, the film gets heavier. Kevin Spacey's Lex Luthor mutilates Superman with sadistic relish. The sequence is so brutal and ugly that Luthor's jokey comeuppance feels monstrously inadequate. But by then, the audience has moved ahead of Singer. Scenes that a director with some comic book snap would have compressed into 15 seconds drag on for minutes, and the lugubrious martyrdom climax would make Wagner check his watch. It's not that the movie is 2.5 hours, it's that it feels like 2.5 hours. Superman Returns does have grace notes. The special effects are often gorgeous, and I love the moment when Clark uses his X-ray vision to watch Lois lift lyrically off in an elevator. As Luther's mole, Parker Posey has a few tart lines, and there's a great scene where Lois and her son overcome a thug with the aid of a grand piano. But even here, Singer lingers too long. The director carries over his X-Men motif, the melancholy of the terminal outsider, in a way that feels bizarrely wrong for Superman. Superman Returns isn't terrible, but it sinks under the weight of its seriousness. It's the first Superman movie that makes being able to fly seem like a curse.
David Edelstein is the film critic for New York Magazine. Earlier this month, I spoke with the Dixie Chicks. As you probably know, there was a great deal of controversy surrounding the group following a critical comment about President Bush made by lead singer Natalie Maines just before the invasion of Iraq. Much of their country music audience was furious with them, and a lot of country stations stopped playing their records. The band members even had to protect themselves against death threats. When I asked them about the boycotts and other repercussions of the controversy, one of the Dixie Chicks mentioned that they had offered to donate $1 million to the Red Cross, but the Red Cross turned them down with a thanks but no thanks reply. The Red Cross has asked us for the opportunity to clarify why they declined the offer of $1 million from the Dixie Chicks. The Red Cross prepared this statement. In 2003, following the controversy that erupted on a London stage, the Dixie Chicks approached the American Red Cross proposing a promotional partnership for their forthcoming summer tour. There was no offer of an unrestricted gift to support the life-saving mission of the Red Cross, as is customary with most donors. The proposed relationship would have called for the Red Cross to publicly embrace a talented group of entertainers during a widely publicized, politically motivated controversy. Since the American Red Cross, like other national Red Cross organizations around the world, must operate within the bounds of its founding principles of impartiality and neutrality, the controversy made it impermissible for the Red Cross to associate itself with the band. Should the Dixie Chicks decide to make an unconditional financial donation to the American Red Cross, we would gladly accept it and put it to work toward our life-saving mission. That's a statement from the American Red Cross. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Julian Hertzfeld and Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, in stores and online at bn.com. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD available at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from Jim and Karen Frank. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After writing a biography of George W. Bush, Bill Minutaglio has written a new book called The President's Counselor, The Rise to Power of Alberto Gonzalez. We'll talk with Minutaglio on the next Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.